Hello, and welcome to another installment of the Sea Realm Podcast. I'm your host, KMO, and this is episode number 140, The Growth Imperative, prepared for release onto the World Wide Web on Wednesday, February 4th, 2009. And in this installment of the podcast, I will be playing a conversation that I recorded with Thomas Homer Dixon. He is the author of several books, including The Upside of Down, Catastrophe, Creativity, and the Renewal of Civilization, of which longtime Sea Realm listeners have heard much on this program. I actually interviewed Thomas Homer Dixon fairly early on in the history of this podcast. I don't have the exact episode number at the tip of my tongue, but I will post a link to it in the show notes for this episode. Of course, you can find the show notes at kmo.livejournal.com, but I'm getting ahead of myself. The very first order of business and the most important thing I do on this show from week to week is thank those people who have used their resources to support what Catherine Austin Fitz calls the real deal media. People who are not constrained by the agenda of selling and maintaining access to power, because people like me have no access to power. But I'll cut that short, because that is an entryway to a rant, which is not appropriate here. What is appropriate here is that I give my sincere thanks to Troy P., Zymoni.com, Colin F., S. Wilkzak, Syntropo.com, Daniel H., and Richard S. It was a very good week for contributions to the Sea Realm podcast, which amazes me because given the direction that the economy is headed, given the fact that on the straight media I hear all the time that people are pulling in economically, reining in their spending, it really is amazing that people who listen to this podcast and who are more than welcome to listen to it for free send me money to help me keep this podcast coming week after week. That means a great deal to me. Thank you. I should mention for people who are listening for the first time that those who send me money do so via the PayPal link, which can be found on the website for this podcast. It is crealmpodcast.podomatic.com. There is a hyphen between the C and the R in C-Realm. C stands for consciousness. And on that page, you'll find two PayPal buttons. One is a subscribe button, which people click on when they wish to set up automatic payments to the C-Realm podcast in the amount of $3 a month. There's also a contribute button, and you would click on that to make a one-time contribution to the C-Realm podcast. Both types are most welcome. I am just astounded and unbelievably gratified that people choose to support the Sea Realm podcast when, as I say, you are more than welcome to listen at no cost to you at all. Also, I have two types of thanks to give to Colin F. this week. Not only has he supported the Sea Realm podcast with his hard-earned dollars, but he has also put me in touch with the musician who provided the musical interlude for this week's show. The musician in question is named Jeff Andrews, and the song that I'll be playing is called Hospital Ship Hope, and that's from his band The Fountains, or The Fontaines, I don't know which. And Jeff also has another band called Jeff Andrews and the Blessed Unrest. And I'll be posting a link to the band's MySpace page in the show notes for this episode. It's kmo.livejournal.com. This is episode number 140. And I have a piece of email to read, and I don't read a lot of email on this program, even though I get a lot of email that really touches me, and I'd like to thank everybody who sends email. This, though, is something that I need to get out early. It's from Larry L., and Larry writes, KMO, so glad to see you on the air again this week. You must know by now that you have an extended family of listeners who support your choices and life effort. And Larry, I do know that. Thank you. Larry continues, I would like to participate in the annual Sea Realm retreat prior to the Shamanism Conference in Iquitos this summer. Can you give me any details on your retreat and the dates, etc., so I can begin planning? Sincerely, Larry L. Well, Larry, I'm not going to Peru this year. I will not be participating in the Shamanism Conference, nor will I have a Sea Realm retreat in the Amazon jungle. I would very much like to have a Sea Realm ayahuasca-themed retreat, but if it happens this year, it's going to be in Mexico. And the reason for that is just that I don't have the time or the resources to travel to Peru this year. A trip to Mexico is much more doable both in terms of time off from work and in terms of money spent getting there and back. So look for, or I should say listen, for details about the Sea Realm Ayahuasca Retreat in Mexico, but there will not be any Sea Realm activities in Peru this summer. Well, let's get into the heart of this week's episode. It is my conversation with Thomas Homer Dixon, and then after that, I have something very special. It is Thomas Homer Dixon giving a reading from his new book, which has yet to be published. It's called Carbon Shift. It comes out in April, and he will be reading from the final chapter of that book. So, Sea Realm exclusive. Actually, it's not going to be a complete exclusive, because I did send the audio file to Radio EcoShock, so you might be hearing it over the airwaves on Radio EcoShock. But that said, here is my most recent interview with Thomas Homer Dixon.
You're listening to the Sea Realm Podcast. C stands for consciousness.
You're listening to the Sea Realm Podcast. I'm your host, KMO, and joining me again here in the Sea Realm by phone from his office in Waterloo, Ontario, is Thomas Homer Dixon. He holds the Center for International Governance Innovation Chair of Global Systems at the Balsillie School of International Affairs in Waterloo, Canada, and is a professor in the Center for Environment and Business in the Faculty of Environment, University of Waterloo. He is the author of several award-winning books, the most recent of which is The Upside of Down, Catastrophe, Creativity, and the Renewal of Civilization. Thomas Homer Dixon, welcome back to the Sea Realm Podcast.
Delighted to be with you.
You have provided a reading from your new book. It is called Carbon Shift, How the Twin Crises of Oil Depletion and Climate Change Will Define the Future, and I'll be playing that later in the program. But first, I am interested in talking about economic matters, and in particular, I keep coming back to the work of Buzz Holling, which you describe in your book, The Upside of Down, and there's one sentence that I would like to read, and then have you explain what that sentence means, and it might take quite a bit of explaining. And the sentence is this: so, we are overextending the growth phase of our global adaptive cycle.
Well, okay, that's a good place to start. Now, your listeners have to realize that preceding that sentence was about 10 pages of spade work in which I sort of defined each of the concepts in that sentence and explained why it's, each concept is important and how they work together. But let me walk through that very quickly for your listeners. First of all, a bit about Buzz Holling. He's a remarkable man. He's an ecologist, Canadian ecologist, now I think approaching 80 years old, still completely vigorous, full of life, and still making a terrific intellectual contribution. He pioneered the investigation of the cycles of adaptation that occur in ecological systems. He started by looking at the spruce forests in New Brunswick in Canada, went on to look at many other ecological systems. And to sort of compress a very long story, he discovered that you could describe the cycles of adaptation and development of ecological systems as occurring in a space, a three-dimensional space, an abstract space, characterized by three variables along each axis of the three-dimensional space. You can think of a cube. One variable is potential, one variable is connectedness, and one variable is resilience. So let's keep those three variables in mind, potential, connectedness, and resilience. By potential, he basically means the amount of information in a system or the capital available in a system. So if you're thinking of a forest, and he uses a forest as a sort of central example, as it's growing and becoming more mature over time, it builds its potential. It builds in particular the total biomass in the forest, the amount of genetic information in the forest, especially if the forest is becoming more diverse with different species and so there's more information in total, genetic information, more capital, more biomass, in a sense, in that forest. So the potential is increasing. As the forest matures, it also becomes more connected. All the elements, the species, of plants and animals, become very tightly interwoven with movements of energy and chemicals and elements back and forth between them, and on a daily basis, and then even on by seconds, and so there are many different time frames operating. You have very short time frames. You have very long time frames that may endure over periods of years with these cycles of materials through all the connections between the species and the organisms in the forest. So that's the connectivity, and that tends to increase over time too. But then the third variable moves in an opposite direction. He discovered that as a forest reaches its most mature stage, it tends to become less resilient. So resilience actually declines. And by resilience, he means the ability to withstand a shock without falling apart, without catastrophic failure. So the forest actually becomes more and more vulnerable to a kind of collapse as it gets older, as its connectivity increases, and as its potential increases. One of the reasons is that because it's so connected, if there's, for instance, a fire or a disease, some kind of pathogen that infects the forest, because the forest is now so connected together, that shock, the fire, the disease, will spread through the forest very quickly and produce a collapse of a larger portion of the ecosystem. But there's another thing that happens that's very interesting. As forests become mature, they tend to become very efficient in converting energy and water and the nutrients in the soil into biomass. And they actually start to eliminate redundancy within the forest ecosystem. So a good example would be nitrogen fixers. All ecosystems require a certain number of organisms called nitrogen fixers to take nitrogen out of the atmosphere and convert it into a form that can be used by plants and then convert it into proteins in animals. Now, as a forest becomes more mature, the diversity of nitrogen fixers actually declines. Ones that aren't absolutely essential are eliminated from the mix of species that are nitrogen fixers, and the forest becomes more and more reliant on a relatively small number of nitrogen fixers. So it's losing resilience. It's becoming more efficient at processing, converting energy, material, and nutrients into biomass, but it's actually becoming more brittle. It's losing resilience. That's the basic model. The hypothesis that Holling puts forward and the researchers who've worked with him, and it's now borne out by a lot of research, is that all complex adaptive systems, and these can include things like market economies, even societies, ecological systems like forests, tend to cycle in this three-dimensional space. They have a growth phase, which is the front loop of the cycle, as referred to in that sentence. They have a growth phase during which the forest or the economy or the society will become more connected, more complex, and will build its potential in terms of its information content and its capital. But over time, will start to lose resilience. At the top of that growth phase, the system becomes very brittle. With a forest, it becomes very vulnerable to disease or to a fire. And when there's a shock of that kind, the system actually collapses. It falls apart. And then there's a back phase of the adaptive cycle, or what they call the back loop, which involves the system reorganizing itself, recombining its components in new ways so that it can be adapted to the new environment that it's in. Now, here's the critical point, and this is really very powerful that comes out of this research, is that these researchers are suggesting that every highly adaptive system has to have a breakdown phase, what they call the omega phase in its cycle. And that breakdown, that loss of resilience, breakdown, crisis, and reorganization of the components of the system are essential to adaptation. This is what the great economist Joseph Schumpeter in the 20th century called creative destruction in market economies. He pointed out that the reason the market economies are so adaptive is that they allow for creative destruction. A company will be founded, it will grow over time. If it's well run, it will prosper. It'll become larger, grow in its potential. But over time, it may lose resilience and may become badly adapted to a changing economic environment. It might go bankrupt eventually, and the human and financial capital of that company can be reorganized in the economy to provide for adaptation. And the overall process is one of really fast and effective adaptation for the economy as a whole. This is a radical idea. And just to conclude my summary of Holling's ideas and their implications, I think the larger story here, and it's one I try to develop in the book, is that our global socio-ecological economic system, and we've really now, humankind has created a tightly coupled, highly connected, high potential global socio-ecological economic system with trade links and movements of material and energy, and with human beings being as large an actor in ecological sense as nature itself on the planet. That system is probably close to the top of the growth phase of the cycle. And in fact, in many respects, we might have prevented, through our management, smaller breakdowns that could have allowed us to adapt. And now we're looking at the possibility of very large breakdowns because we've prevented smaller breakdowns in the past. We have lost resilience. And I think the story of this financial crisis that we're going through right now is exactly the kind of thing that Holling was talking about. It's exactly the kind of thing that I anticipated within my book, The Upside of Down. We have an extremely brittle global economy that now is generating cascading failures that are affecting literally billions of people around the planet.
I'd like to read one other sentence, and this is from the previous page. It's another short sentence, but it's not quite so packed as the previous one. And it is this: the longer people sustain a social, economic, or ecological system in its growth phase, the sharper, harder, and more destructive its ultimate breakdown will be. And it seems that the promise of any politician is that he will extend the growth phase of the adaptive cycle at least out through the end of his administration, and thereby not be around when the eventual collapse comes. Now, they don't admit that a collapse is inevitable. The adaptive growth cycle model is not something that is, you know, incorporated into the presentation of where they think we're going. We are sold a message of continual economic growth that will go on indefinitely. And it seems to me that there are a lot of people who are very hopeful right now that the Obama administration will manage to somehow extend the growth phase of our adaptive cycle for another 4 or 8 years and thereby make the eventual crash all that much worse. And I wonder what your thoughts are on that specific application of the general topic we've been discussing.
Well, you've got it exactly right. We ask our leaders, whether they're our business leaders, corporate leaders, political leaders, basically to keep things the way they are on the current trajectory. And the current trajectory has been growth and increase in connectivity and complexity. And we want them to keep us on that trajectory. And the implication, if Holling and these other theorists are correct, is that all that's going to do is make the eventual crisis that much worse, the breakdown that much worse. Now, you can tell a story about the current economic crisis in exactly these terms. We would have been a lot better off if policymakers, bankers, hadn't manipulated the economic incentives and the economic conditions to allow for the creation of these enormous equity bubbles over the last couple of decades. And I can remember a very prescient cover on The Economist, I think it was back in the mid-1990s, and it was showed a picture of a trader, probably Wall Street or something like that, falling out of a skyscraper. You know, obviously having thrown himself out because of a financial crisis. And the headline across the front of the Economist was "Crash, damn it." And what the Economist editors were arguing is that we'd be a lot better off if there were small breakdowns in the system fairly regularly, which would mean small economic crashes, rather than trying to manipulate the system in such ways by reducing interest rates and covering people's economic bets, allowing people to build up enormous debts, by manipulating the system in various ways so that so that these small crises don't occur. In terms of an ecological system like a forest, the parallel is really quite extraordinary. What you want in a forest is smaller, more regular shocks, say fires, that don't wipe out large sections of the forest, but open up space for adaptivity that allow light in, that clear the land, that allow for change of various kinds, the introduction of new species, rearrangement of relations among species. What you don't want to do is prevent forest fires over long periods of time, because then you get an accumulation of an enormous amount of biomass that's extremely flammable. And when you do have a fire, it's an enormous fire, it's extremely hot. And as Holling points out, it's so hot that it destroys the seeds that will allow for the regermination of a forest subsequently. So it actually destroys the potential for creativity and adaptation. And in many respects, that's what we ask, in asking our politicians and leaders to keep things as they are, to maintain growth indefinitely, to allow the front loop of the growth cycle, of the adaptive cycle, to be extended indefinitely. We're actually increasing the probability that we're going to have a crisis that's so large eventually that we won't be able to adapt. We won't be able to respond creatively. That's a pathological outcome of the adaptive cycle. And I think, again, Holling is very insightful about this.
Have you heard of a ship called the Hospital Hope? Have you purchased your ticket, stood in line, and brought your soap? Pull your rope off that rock, set adrift, set afloat. Kissed all your girls goodbye, mothers, fathers, sisters, to your wave. Set a course for continents, for glaciers, and for thieves. And do you know what it takes to be believed? Well, have you asked yourself just where is it that you're sailing? Do you wonder what it takes to bring a grown man to whaling? Sometimes when I am all alone, lay lonely in my bed, I cast away my soul to another place instead. See what it takes to wake me up and arouse me from my slumber. Creak along to help another brother. Well, have you seen the aching faces on all those little children? Heard the horrid numbers of the armaments we're using? Don't it make you angry, sometimes make you wanna hate? Feeling so dejected, only so much more I'll take. Where to start, not to stop? Horror ocean, hill or dune, you know the breaking point will come together soon. Have you thought it'd be nice to overcome your fears? Join the revolution, it's the first one in some years. Leave alone the weak who think there's nothing they can do. Tell them we don't want them if their ship is sinking, shoo. 'Cause when they have the chance to board our vessel in its port. Silence sat them people in their court. Do you dream of a day when liars shed their skins? Have you been keeping a record of the places that you've been? Well, then come along, oh, come along. Together we can grow together strong. Well, come along. Count the days, it won't be long. Smile and count the days, it won't be long.
You're listening to the Sea Realm podcast. Turn on, tune in, and take heart.
You are listening to the Sea Realm podcast. I'm your host, KMO. And I'm joined by Thomas Homer Dixon. He is the author of several books, including the award-winning The Upside of Down, Catastrophe, Creativity, and the Renewal of Civilization. And we have been talking about growth phases and adaptive cycles and how the extending of the growth phase of an adaptive cycle makes the eventual correction all that much more severe and jarring. And I would like to talk a bit about employment and what you call in your book the growth imperative, and how that relates to employment, and how that relates to the money supply and technology. And again, this is a very large question, and it will require a long answer, so I will stop talking and let you approach that from whichever angle you think is most effective.
That's a question that, of course, is central to our current crisis, but it's one that doesn't get asked, and I find that somewhat discouraging. I think it will get asked more as time goes on, but there are some actually very deep contradictions and inconsistencies, you might say, within our current economic system. To put the argument in its shortest form, it's that we are obliged to maintain growth, because if we don't, our societies will fall apart, not just our economies, but what growth does is it provides a lubricant between rich and poor. And it allows for some semblance of social stability, because we haven't dealt with the underlying problems of inequity, of disparities between rich and poor, and we cope with them over long periods of time by generating economic growth that allows for some trickle down and expands the overall pie so that everybody can feel happy enough that they don't revolt against the system. As soon as growth stops, you have the prospect of a zero-sum competition between rich and poor. Now, we learned a very tough lesson in the 1930s that I think has penetrated deeply into our culture, and especially the culture of economists and economic policymakers. And that lesson is that a failure of demand, a failure of consumption in an economy can be catastrophic. A deflationary cycle can be catastrophic. Because it sends unemployment skyrocketing. And when you have very high unemployment, especially a rapid rise of unemployment following a period when the economy was doing reasonably well, you can get political radicalization. And you can get the development of social pathologies such as national socialism. And we saw the consequences of that. It cost 50 million lives and produced the Holocaust. And the policy response, one of the most important policy responses to that social disaster, was Keynesian economics and the adoption of Keynesian economics, which is basically an economic system or theory that allows for the perpetuation of growth indefinitely, economic growth. And here's the reason, the underlying problem that you were alluding to in your question. Capitalist market economies are extraordinarily adaptive, and they are adaptive in large part because they generate constant technological change. Firms compete with each other to reduce their costs so they can reduce the prices of the goods and services that they sell and capture more market share. One of the principal ways that they can reduce their costs is by increasing the productivity of capital, of the machinery that they use, of the physical plant, the factories that they use, producing more widgets essentially per unit of labor. So they want to increase the productivity of capital and they want to increase the productivity of labor. But one of the results is that, especially when it comes to labor, if you increase the productivity, you don't need as much of it. So there is a constant process of displacement, technological displacement of labor in our economies. Quite understandable, quite natural. There's no malign intent here on the part of companies. They're just doing what they have to do to survive. They need to increase the productivity of capital and labor, and in the process, they use fewer and fewer people to produce the same stream of goods. Now, those people who are disemployed by technological change have to be absorbed somehow if you're not going to have the development of a potentially easily radicalized group of people within a society who are unemployed or underemployed. And the way we've learned how to do that, what Keynes basically showed us, was we've learned mechanisms for maintaining economic growth to absorb that technologically displaced labor, especially by maintaining consumption. We have to maintain consumption. Of course, this technologically displaced labor has to be reemployed in the economy so that it can be consuming stuff, so those people who would otherwise be unemployed can be consuming things because otherwise they are going to contribute to a demand failure in the economy too. So the whole point of economic growth is to keep the expansion of the economy sufficient to absorb workers who would otherwise be unemployed, especially by technological change. Now, the figures are really quite astonishing. On an annual basis in the United States, the American economy needs about 3% growth in real terms simply to prevent unemployment from rising. Now, that's partly because the population is growing and there's immigration, but a very significant portion of that 3% goes towards absorbing unemployment that's created by technological change. So we're hooked on growth. If we don't maintain growth, we're going to have steadily expanding unemployment in our economy, and that will have really disastrous social consequences. We've learned, I think, over time, partly because of the lessons of the Depression and then the Second World War that followed, that growth equals peace. And I think even going farther back in history, we've learned the lesson even drawn from, say, the Enlightenment and perhaps even farther back to the notions of progress that developed in the Renaissance, that growth equals freedom. Now, that's a very powerful cultural combination. Growth equals peace and growth equals freedom. And it's very difficult for anybody to challenge the assumption that growth is a good thing. Of course, on the other side of this equation, we have a global ecosystem that's increasingly showing the consequences of this perpetual growth. We have a world climate that is changing because of the enormous output of waste from the global economy. The World Bank anticipates that the global economy will grow at 3% a year, in real terms, 2.5 to 3% a year, more or less indefinitely into the future. Obviously, that's not going to happen for the next couple of years because of the economic crisis, but that's its anticipated target growth rate. Well, that produces a doubling time of around 20 years. Every 20 years, the global economy will double every 20 to 25 years in real terms, in terms of its real economic output. We're already at a $70 trillion global economy. If we go out 40 or 50 years into the future with a 3% growth rate, doubling every 20 to 25 years, that means we will quadruple the size of the global economy by the time my children are my age, from $70 trillion to pretty close to $300 trillion. That's not going to happen. we had a global environment that's already suffering the consequences, the really dramatic consequences in terms of its incapacity to absorb the waste from our economic output. We have a resource system that's under stress, particularly in terms of energy production and the ability to find the energy we need to drive our global economy. Even at $70 trillion, it's simply inconceivable that an economy of $280 trillion is going to be sustainable within the finite limits of this planet. So we face a really absolutely inescapable contradiction, in a sense, between the underlying need for growth to maintain social stability on one hand and the imperatives of our global ecology on the other. And nobody's really talking about this, but we need to because it's probably the central crisis of this century.
Well, that is a frustrating place to have to end, but I realize that you have a meeting starting in less than 10 minutes. So,
I suppose that means we just have to have another conversation before too long.
Well, I would like to do that after I've had a chance to read Carbon Shift.
Very good.
Well, Thomas Homer Dixon, it has been an absolute pleasure having you on the program, and I would very much like to invite you back to continue this conversation, and I'm sure that the audience would like to have you back as well.
Well, Camo, it has been a delight, as usual. I really enjoy these conversations, and your questions are always right to the point and really take us places that I rarely get taken in my interviews. So thanks very much. It's been terrific.
You are listening to the Sea Realm podcast. It's all good.
Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome.
August 22nd, 2027. Ilulissat, Denmark, Reuters. A steady flow of scientists, journalists, Danish officials, and eco-spectators has arrived in this settlement on the west coast of Greenland as thousands of icebergs break off the nearby Jakobshavn Glacier each day and stream past the town. In the last 4 weeks, the glacier has surged off the Greenland landmass, producing a sharp acceleration of ice discharge into the North Atlantic. Glaciers elsewhere on both the east and west coasts of Greenland have shown similar dramatic acceleration of ice loss. Scientists believe these developments signal the start of large-scale disintegration of Greenland's ice sheets and rapid rise of the world's sea levels. What kind of future are we handing our children? If it includes news stories like the one I've just read, today's generation of adults will have failed to meet one of its most fundamental responsibilities, to ensure our children's safety, security, and opportunity to flourish. Every day that we deny, dissemble, and delay and every day that we avoid the tough choices and costs of dealing with our twin energy and climate crises, we make it more likely that, at some point, our children, perhaps as young adults, will wake up in a world in which they no longer control their climate fate, in which, for instance, it's too late to stop the collapse of the planet's great ice sheets. Although the authors of this book's chapters disagree about many things, they all agree fundamentally that we need to change how we see the world and how we act. In our everyday lives, we need to see and understand the energy and climate consequences of our behavior, and we need to change that behavior to protect our children's future. All the authors here are deeply frustrated by the half-heartedness of our efforts so far and the current poverty of serious proposals to alter our direction, and they all fear that we won't take these challenges seriously until it's too late. In the period during which this book was written and edited, the world seemed to go haywire. An economic bubble created by decades of cheap credit and the undervaluing of risk, centered in the U.S. housing sector but replicated in different ways in economies around the world, imploded, producing a financial crisis of astonishing breadth, depth, and persistence. Commodity prices that had rocketed upward suddenly collapsed as demand vanished and hedge funds and other speculators sold their positions to pay down their debts. Oil, which spiked to $147 a barrel in June 2008, plummeted below $60 by mid-November 2008. But almost unnoticed in the background of this tumult, companies and utilities were ramping up their use of coal, and humankind's emissions of carbon dioxide shot past the worst-case scenario of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. In the summers of 2007 and 2008, Arctic ice disappeared at record speed. Meanwhile, in British Columbia and in federal politics, Canadians showed scant enthusiasm for proposals to tax carbon emissions. When it comes to our energy and climate problems, we're going in diametrically the opposite direction to where we should be going. And while the world's current economic crisis legitimately demands policymakers' attention, its consequences, no matter how severe, will pale beside the long-term consequences to humankind of energy scarcity and climate change. For all their capacity to radically alter nearly every facet of our civilization, these threats rarely capture our imaginations. They develop incrementally, and their consequences are both uncertain and relatively distant in time and space. They are what specialists call wicked problems. As David Keith points out in his chapter here, climate change in particular is characterized by high uncertainty and high inertia. Systems with lots of uncertainty and inertia are notoriously hard to control because we can't effectively predict their future behavior and we can't quickly correct behavior we don't like. So such systems give us enormous scope for denial and procrastination. But the carbon challenge is real, and deep change in our lives, economies, and societies is inevitable. It would be a mistake to conclude from the disagreements between the experts in this book that we should wait to see what happens before we act. David Keith and David Hughes may argue about the relative importance of climate change and fossil depletion. Mark Jacquard and Jeff Rubin may disagree on whether markets will accurately price the energy that powers our civilizations. But to interpret these disagreements as reasons to delay would be a self-serving rationalization, just as self-serving as the commonplace rationalizations highlighted by William Marsden and Jeffrey Simpson, that we can enjoy the wealth and energy of the tar sands without acknowledging the staggering environmental costs, and that we can soothe our consciences by endorsing a green political agenda, even as we vote for parties and policies that fail to address the problems we claim we want solved. All the authors in this book agree we face a series of challenges that will shake our priorities, our assumptions about our entitlements, and our expectations for the future. Whether the risk is that humankind will release enough of Earth's stored carbon to make the planet uninhabitable, as David Keith fears, or that humankind will find there aren't enough hydrocarbons in the ground to keep the global economy operational, as David Hughes warns, a carbon shift, either voluntary or involuntary, is now unavoidable. It had better be voluntary. To do little or nothing now in the face of inevitable change is to invite disaster, if not upon ourselves, then upon future generations. In fact, one way or the other, whether we change our behavior or not, we're betting the fate of our children, and the simple question is, which bet do we want to make? Do we bet that energy scarcity and climate change aren't going to hurt the world badly and invest our resources elsewhere? If we're right, we save some money, but if we're wrong, the consequences for our children could be catastrophic. Or do we bet that energy scarcity and climate change could indeed hurt the world badly and invest to prevent that outcome? If we're right, our children avoid possible catastrophe. But if we're wrong, we lose some money. Put this way, the answer seems obvious. Investment now to prevent potentially catastrophic consequences in the future, even very significant investment, is entirely rational. Or at least the answer should seem obvious if we weren't deeply hardened in our narrow, narcissistic, present-day self-interest.
You're listening to the Sea Realm Podcast.
Your mind, one week at a time.
That was Thomas Homer Dixon reading from his new book, Carbon Shift, How the Twin Crises of Oil Depletion and Climate Change Will Define the Future. This book is due out on April 14th, 2009, but it is available for pre-order from Amazon.com now, and so I have put it in the Sea Realm Amazon bookstore, and you can find a link to that from the Podomatic page, or I will also have a link to it in the show notes for this episode, which, as always, you can find on my blog. It's kmo.livejournal.com. And because we have a few minutes left, I would like to read something from The Upside of Down. In order to get in all the material that I want to get in, I'm going to be reading rather selectively from the book, but the portion that I'll be reading starts on page 214 in a section that is entitled, Why Don't We Face Reality? And Thomas Homer Dixon writes, "A puzzle remains. Avoiding evidence of our problems, denying their existence, displacing responsibility for dealing with them onto others, or falsely believing we can fix them when they get bad are all, in the end, rotten strategies for survival in our more dangerous world. Why do we adopt these strategies if they are so bad for us? Denial has both psychological and social causes. Psychologically, we often choose to ignore things that scare us, or that threaten assumptions that give our lives meaning and security. We also have great difficulty taking novel threats seriously, because we tend to imagine the future through the lens of the past. For instance, the use of civilian airliners against skyscrapers wasn't implausible, it just hadn't happened before the 9/11 attacks, and American policymakers couldn't imagine that kind of threat, although some intelligence analysts did suggest such attacks were possible. Anyone in senior circles in the U.S. government who had pushed the possibility aggressively would have been regarded as a kook. Also, our brains aren't good at identifying, tracking, and acting on slow creep problems. Problems like global warming develop incrementally over long periods of time. They can become critical in an instant when the underlying stress crosses an unknowable threshold. We don't see the slowly building pressure as we adapt almost unconsciously to incremental changes in our surroundings. Our attention is instead drawn to things that change quickly and substantially. This problem is made worse when a great deal of uncertainty surrounds the change. If there's at least the possibility of a happy ending, we often choose to emphasize that possibility, however remote, while ignoring the rest of the story. Finally, and perhaps most fundamentally, our brains are adapted to a world with generally weak connections among events. In the lives of our ancestors tens of thousands of years ago, problems like finding food, preparing shelter, and defending against marauding tribes could usually be separated from each other and addressed sequentially. Our brains, with their limited processing power, could ignore most of the world's complexity because most of it didn't matter to our day-to-day survival. Today, though, our world is vastly different. It's far more tightly connected together, and the problems it generates are often horribly entangled. But our brains are largely the same as our ancestors' brains, so we don't easily see the links and synergies among our problems, and we often can't see how serious our situation is. Then there are the social causes of denial, probably the most important of which is the self-interest of powerful groups. Corporations, government agencies, lobbyists, religious institutions, unions, non-governmental organizations, and the like. They have a vested interest in a particular way of doing things, or viewing the world. If outside evidence doesn't fit their worldview, these groups can cajole, co-opt, or coerce other people to deny this evidence. Some groups, of course, will be much more effective in their effort than others, owing to their enormous political and economic power. In the United States, for example, some of the world's biggest coal extractors, oil and gas producers, and auto manufacturers have financed an immense and, for a long time, largely successful effort to discredit mainstream climate science and scientists. And actually, I could keep reading for page after page, and it would be very relevant, and I think very interesting to people who who are listening to this podcast, but instead I will just encourage you to find a copy of The Upside of Down, Catastrophe, Creativity, and the Renewal of Civilization by Thomas Homer Dixon. Read it, become familiar with the arguments made in the book, and then don't be a fanatical street corner preacher, but just have these arguments, have this information in your mind, and have it available to help you in making decisions and influencing people in a gentle, subtle, integral way. We need to change minds, we need to change consciousness, and browbeating and sermonizing are not the way to go. So just integrate it into your thinking, and then express yourself congruently, naturally, spontaneously. And know that in so doing, you really are making the world a better place. Well, that is all for this installment of the Sea Realm Podcast. This episode, like every episode, is distributed under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, Share-Alike 3.0 license, and it is, therefore, available for your use. So I would encourage you to take advantage of that fact and share the Sea Realm Podcast in a way that infuses it with your own creativity. I don't know what next week holds. I think that I will have an interview from Yasmina to play, but I am not certain. I have not yet received it. But regardless of what happens, I fully intend to be back here 1 week from today with episode number 141. I hope that you will join me. And until that time, I hope that you will stay well.